Great. So welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia on a Sunday morning. This is our final Sunday morning for what we would call the winter session or the school year. The summer sessions will start next week. We'll take a moment first to explain just who the United Lodge is and some announcements, and then we will follow it up with the program. So first and foremost, you might find on the back of the periodical something that we call the Declaration. This Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists is the simple, sole guiding document of all the United Lodges throughout the world. So this is not a place of red tape, but it's a place of earnest hearts for those who are in accordance with the philosophy and seek to participate in the effort of the Theosophical movement. So we'll take a minute to read this Declaration since there's several new folks here. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So very quickly, we find that this is not a statement of creeds, of what to do and what not to do, but simply an invitation to any seekers who would test, check, and verify these universal ideas for themselves, and to the degree that one finds oneself in accordance with these universal principles, to think and act from that basis, and you're invited to come and study the philosophy with others. Well, to carry out the principles of this program, we have two meetings per month. The first, of course, on a Sunday. The doors open to 10:30. Everyone's welcome. Everybody's welcome. The meetings are always free to the public. And so on a Sunday morning, the meeting actually begins at 11 and goes till 12, and typically all of our meetings are a presentation of ideas and then discussion and questions, contributions, and that takes up most of the hour. The presentation takes up the first portion of the hour. The rest of the hour is the discussion and principles. Okay, so that's on a Sunday. Then on Wednesdays in the evening, the doors open at 5:15. There's a reference library open to the public from 5:15 to 7:15. Not a lending library, but if there's a particular thing that you're looking for, a particular line of thought that you're following up on, or if you simply prefer to come on a Wednesday afternoon to read and prepare for the Wednesday evening study class, you're certainly welcome to. That Wednesday evening study class is from 7:30 to 8:30. Outside of this lecture hall, there's also a book table. It's open before and after meetings and during library hours, where you'll find only straight line theosophical literature, books, pamphlets, and magazine. We sell them at cost to the lodge. This is not a profit-making organization, but also if you care to, so you can buy them and bring them home, or if you care to look online, talk to the person at the table, and we'll direct you to the best websites for that kind of information. Virtually all the straight line theosophical literature is online. So now, for the summer, beginning Wednesday evenings, we're studying the Bhagavad Gita. That will go through October. And then on Sunday mornings, we're studying a devotional book called The Light of Asia. That will be every Sunday through the summer. Thank you. The Light on the Path. Thank you. That will be every Sunday through the summer. Except during the summer, on Sundays, we take the month of August off. So Sundays, you're welcome to come through July and September, but August Sundays, we take off. Wednesdays with the Bhagavad Gita is straight through the summer.
Okay.
Well, finally, this lodge and all the lodges throughout the world are sustained entirely on voluntary contributions of time, efforts, and money. We do not hire speakers. We pay no money to have students do any of the work here. So anything that you see going on is purely voluntary work. And any contributions along those lines are certainly welcome from everybody. If you have a talent or if you care to contribute in any other way, please talk to the student at the book table, and your contributions are welcome. That being said, our next step is we will have a fellow volunteer summarize the article that we're studying today. That article is written by Robert Crosby, the founder of the United Lodge of Theosophists. And the title of that article is The Foundation of Religions. And to the degree that you care to, you're welcome to follow along in the book as the summary is given.
Should know that to summarize is to bring out the salient points, the main ideas, the important sentences. Well, if you've read this article, you know that almost every sentence is an important one, so it really can't be summarized. It can just be tackled. And we would recommend to all of you that if these ideas interest you, read that article, but don't just read it once. We first have a definition of religion for most people here and in the United States, and that's that it's a preparation for a final future existence, or it's the development of ideas by an individual and turned into a particular religion. Or it's, as most, it's the revelations of a supreme being. Now, theosophy says that each people, therefore, has a god of their own. So many peoples, so many supreme beings. All these gods, or supreme beings, are the creation of men. But back of that idea lies a reality. And sometimes we'll be quoting from the part. The power in man to create ideas and images and endow them points to something greater than the things created. That which in man creates ideas is greater than any idea he may at any time have held or now holds. We have then to get back of ideas to find true religion. Standing is so hard. No, it's okay. It's kind of fun, actually. Okay. Kind of exercise. True religion gives a basis for thinking and acting. It's an understanding of nature, of ourselves, and of other beings. Religion is a bond uniting men together. And that's the actual meaning of the word, religare. It's Latin for to bind together. It's not a particular set of dogmas or beliefs. It binds not only all men, but all beings and all things in the universe, in the entire universe, into one grand whole. Behind that reality is the sustainer of all that exists, omnipresent and infinite. Now, in the popular idea, God is the supreme being, but no being can exist outside of space, and the highest power, therefore, cannot be less than space. So we're told to hold that as a sort of metaphor, that supreme spirit, which is not a being, cannot be less than space. This drives us back to the very basis of all thought, the power to think itself, the power which is in each and everything. The thinker is the true self, the one life, the one consciousness, the one power. Now, all our action proceeds from that basis, thought. The greater the powers which flow from the spiritual quality, the greater the increase of knowledge, absolutely accurate knowledge. Knowledge is religion. Beings above us learn how to know their innermost nature and to act in accordance with it. They came to know that true religion is a knowledge of one's own self and then action in accordance with that knowledge. Only knowledge acquired and the use of that knowledge makes the difference between all beings. That statement, of course, says that the only difference between the Buddha and ourselves is the knowledge and action. Well, what prevents us, if that's so, if within we are Buddha? Our minds are filled with narrow ideas of life and purpose and humanity and of ourselves. It is our beliefs which constrain us. It is our very spiritual nature, our own use of our own powers, which makes present unhappy conditions possible. For from it flows the one power. Each man is his own creator, and each one has to be his own savior through learning the right use of that one power. Those who have learned can only point out to us the way they learned. No one can learn for us. We ourselves have to clear away the obstacles that prevent us from seeing the truth. There is one realization which immediately sets our minds in order. It is of that in us which is unchangeable and unchanging. We are that spirit in very essence. All that has been in our past lives and in our present life, all that will be in the future, proceeds from the power of that spirit itself and is sustained by the power of that spirit itself. There is nothing apart from us. Nature does not exist separate and apart from us. All the powers in the universe are latent in us. We have to open the doors to their use. Everyone is a little copy of the universe. And there's two interesting statements if we were not immortal in our very natures, never by any chance could we become immortal. If we were less than divinity, then we never could, by any possibility, understand divinity. Those beings who have been men and who have gone beyond our degrees of illusion have attained to their divinity. They accept the woes of birth to which their younger brothers, us, are subject, to remind us of our own natures, the only natures over which we have permanent control, that we may become as one of them, bound to them as to all nature. To live for others is the foundation and basis of religion, of true spiritual knowledge.
Well, one of the three objects of the Theosophical movement is that each student is invited to study the religions of all the world, both past and current religions, as well as all of the sciences, and to demonstrate the value of that study. You may have found here in today's talk that a theosophical view, or the study of religion in the light of theosophy, brings upon the student a realization that we are immortal souls here using this body. We're not a body that has a soul. And that it's our responsibility to do the work to learn what we need to learn in terms of responsibility, in terms of karma. And we will always have the opportunity to learn that because the soul continuously reincarnates. So your contributions and your questions along these lines, whether your personal religious views to see, to compass, to contrast, or other questions regarding this particular article are certainly invited. Yes?
So the question is, how do we realize our divinity and the moral aspect that we're talking about with this God within? How do we come in contact?
Right. So the question to start off with is, how do we come to realize our divinity? And, well, it's probably, according to the article, probably a good start is to find out what's holding us back from doing that in the first place. And he says that when trying to understand true religion, and when we say true religion, he says that knowledge and religion is the same thing. When he talks about knowledge, he's not talking about knowledge of a trade or of a degree, but knowledge of the self. So knowledge of the self is true religion. The question is, how do we come to understand our divinity? Well, step one, it seems, what's preventing us from understanding true religion or ourselves? And he says, first, it's our minds that are filled with narrow ideas, false beliefs that constrain us, and our very spiritual nature, which creates unhappy conditions because of the way that we think. So if that's the case, then what are some of the things that we need to do to open ourselves to the true divinity? Does this question have to do with this question?
Yes, because okay.
We can't hear you.
Yes. We recall as children, our parents say, get yourself together so that you can be ready for exams. Get yourself together. Those are things that we've heard before. But here, we're taught to think about the terms used. Get yourself together so that you can be prepared. Well, that has a notation that takes place in the mind. Get yourself together. Can you expand on that?
Thank you. So this idea of getting oneself together, there through the use of mind, through the use of ideas, what's important is that we're concentrated and that we focus on the right ideas. As was said in the article, it's our very spiritual powers that create and cause the problems in our conditions. So it would seem right use of our spiritual powers is necessary, and that has to do with the use of mind. Any other contributions along this idea?
Well, we think it's important to search out new ideas and see if they bring out something in you. Otherwise, reject them and go on. And I mean, read Plato, read anything you can read, and see if it fits with your way of thinking.
Aha. So the contribution is consider new ideas and compare and contrast them to what we thought was the true ideas in life. A lot of folks who are raised perhaps in the traditional way in certain religions are directed in along a particular narrow way that reject, if they're not like me, then they're not saved as I am. So there's an issue here. Because theosophy would teach, does teach, that if the different religions of the world are read and thought about in the right context, that there's a lot more similarity among them than perhaps the priestcraft of the world has been teaching the world. Any other ideas along that line? Yes.
The discussion so far has alluded to the fact that all of life is alive, or conscious, or it's presenting that perhaps all have that divinity within it, or this you know, consciousness. That's a very old idea, that all of life is alive. So how that very fact alone, that there cannot therefore be an outside God, because everything comes from within and evolves outward.
Thank you. So the contribution / question has to do with, everything's alive in nature. So does that not suggest the divinity in all nature as opposed to a divine being creating nature? One thing Mr. Crosby points to is, so too we are taking from the powers of nature the additions which other beings have put into it, the forces which other beings have aroused in nature. So when in theosophical context, when we talk about nature, it's helpful to bear in mind, just kind of do an experiment. If we think about or look at nature, just as an experiment, do away with all of the forms that we see. We see, the squirrels, the trees, the leaves, all of these physical things that we see. And imagine the forces, the invisible faculties, the energies, and the forces that come together, which make those physical forms possible. Theosophy says that is nature. Nature is soul, ever evolving under the rule of law inherent in the whole. And nature is defined by Mr. Crosby as, we don't mean to name one person, you'll find it throughout the theosophical literature, it's just his article that we're talking about, that nature is the interrelation and the interaction and the interdependence of all the intelligences, of all the forms of the intelligences in the whole, together as one. So, behind those forms, there is a directing force. And we participate in that directing force, and we can reach behind that and consider that in there is the divinity, the God in nature, if you will. Yes.
Well, are you saying then that we create the universe, we create the world in which we live? You're alluding to the fact that we have all these powers, and nature's all around us, and we influence it. So what's happening in the world right now is from our own thinking.
Right. Well, certainly, am I saying that? It doesn't matter what we say. The question is, what does the philosophy say along those lines? And the philosophy indeed says that the human being is a microcosm of the universe himself, and that everything that goes on within our world is co-created by all of us together. So in that sense, we can say, yes, men are many, but humanity is one. And we are the driving force behind all of the forces of nature which bring about this world that we live in. There was a hand here?
I think I was going to say, like, even the word nature in itself is, like, it means, like, it's, like, so the nature, it means, like, what something is like. So for me, nature just reflects, nature is, like, what God is like. What we know is nature, at least. So it would really just be, nature is sort of, like, it's a consequence of that creative force. It's just everything that everything happens to be like is simply what it is like to be God. And also that, I mean, since everything has sprung from one original germ that was connected to itself at one point, you can look at you as the creator, as I as the creator, anything as like the center point of the universe. Just like Earth is a sphere, so you could, there's no center point on the surface. You can look at any point and look at the radiating out from it. And also I think that, I like to think that whatever our universe is, whatever the creator of that instance of the universe is, that there's infinite instances with infinite creators, and those are all created by a creator, and then there's infinite of those, and those are all created by a creator. And if you're like within the actual process of creation as connected to things that are in reality or nature, that there's no end, and that sort of, but the entire idea of a creative process, that's like the ultimate creator, which is outside of everything.
Thank you. And actually, the philosophy would agree with that on so many points, in particular where we started with the word nature. What does it really mean? In the philosophy, look at nature in its etymology as in nascent, as in as in nativity, as in birth. So nature is ever giving birth to itself. Nothing ever stops changing in nature. So words matter, and in the philosophy, the implication that the creator created something suggests that there's a God, a being with hands that does something and makes something, whereas perhaps a more helpful idea is that the universe comes forth from within, that it's a process that occurs infinitely under law, and it doesn't start, so to speak. We can say, on the one hand, there's the point. But that point, you've heard the point in the circle with the circumference, the invitation to the student of the philosophy is, if we could imagine a point in the circle where the circle, the circumference of the circle, is nowhere. And that point, rather than there being billions of points, instead, that point is everything everywhere, and it's the source of everything. So instead of using the word creator and created, what's helpful is the idea of emanation, and then something that emanates, comes forth from within. There was a hand here. No. Right. Yes, please.
Oh, yes. Well, I was, this was going back to the question of how we can connect with our divinity. And I was just thinking, I've lost my train of thought a bit, but my understanding is that if we practice kind of the best qualities of ourselves and these ideas, if we put them into practice and act in service of others while also being true to the goodness in ourselves, and also then to spend some time in stillness and meditation, then those are helpful.
Well, you've obviously read the article.
Not fully yet.
let's see, hold on. They came to know, they being beings that are far more advanced than we. They came to know that true religion is a knowledge of oneself and action in accordance with that. Drawing nearer in themselves to the very source of their being, they found the source of every other being to be the same. Only the knowledge acquired and the use of that knowledge making the difference between all beings. And so it goes on to talk about the use of that knowledge is service to others. And one helpful a helpful aphorism in the philosophy, which you'll find in another, in The Voice of the Silence, written by HPV, is self-knowledge is of loving deeds the child. Self-knowledge, knowledge of our own true self, is of loving deeds the child. So in other words, live a life of loving deeds, and one will bring forth from that knowledge of oneself. It's not in a book. It's, you know, action and knowledge has to go hand in hand. Yes, oh wait, there was a hand here, yes.
In the previous question,
right.
To understand this, we look back in history to sort of study of ancient religions, and we see where ancient civilizations from the Aztecs, the Incas, South America, Egypt, they worship the sun. The sun was a symbol of a deific principle, that it was the life giver. Is that, we even see the analogy spoken of in theosophy, is that we are all a ray of that great sun. So that light and the darkness are the world's eternal way. So the light is what we all are. I mean, everything is the light. And it's just, it has covered itself in matter, and it's trying to come forth to higher states of matter. So, you know, we are evolving not from the bottom up, but from spirit into matter. So, you know, we are, again, it goes back to that idea that we are divine beings.
Thank you. So this contribution started off with the idea that, you know, so many ancient civilizations, and we'll use the word worshipped the sun, and we think that the wise ones among those civilizations would all agree with the very theosophical concept that, you know, symbols represent, can be used to represent universal truths. And the problem that religion can sometimes fall into is when the wise ones of that religion forgets the truths, only remembers the symbol, so they take that symbol and they hold it up as, this is the truth, and everybody believes it. Well, in ancient times, as these ideas come forward, prior to man, really sounds different, but prior to man becoming so intellectual, the more intellectual we get, the greater challenges we have maintaining a knowledge and an awareness of our own spiritual self. So prior to this, it was common for ancient civilizations to commonly look to the sun. Why were they really praying to the sun? Perhaps, you know, the masses in certain ways, but at the same time, that sun represented something beyond what the sun was. And the fact that it is so universal among the continents, among civilizations, throughout time, that there's something going on there that is of worthy study. To direct our ideas to some of the aspects of what the sun represents can be a healthy exercise, more so than, you know, a dogmatic set of creeds that we need to recite or what have you. Was there another hand? Yes.
We were thinking back to the question about the point in the circle.
Yes.
If you take the human being, every one of us was an egg. And it required merely an activator, the sperm. Nothing was brought to that. It all developed from within itself in a regular progression But we always tend to forget what's also contained within that developing egg are future eggs and future sperm, depending on which gender it becomes. So it carries the future with us. It's the same as what you said about that point within the circle. It is infinite, because when those babies are born, the same process will happen. So you have enough eggs and sperm to cover the world.
So, and
know,
that's it. No, and so as we discuss this, let's bear in mind, remember, you know, these physical things are helpful to get the idea, but behind the physical idea, there are correspondences to the spiritual realm. You know, ideas themselves give birth to other ideas, or are the cause of us to understand things. You know, we have this one book in the library. So there's a book called The Ocean of Theosophy, and it's a wonderful book. It's kind of a condensation or a Reader's Digest version of the entire philosophy. Then there's a companion book called The Answers to Questions in the Ocean of Theosophy, because when you read the ocean, like, it stirs a lot of questions. So then when you read The Answers to Questions, that brings on like so many more answers that they didn't write a book for. So just like the egg is in it, just like, you know, from one tiny acorn, a mighty oak grows, and then unlimited acorns. That's the case with ideas. That's the case with true ideas. True ideas are infinite ideas. False ideas eventually fall to the wayside when the mind that believes in that false idea becomes enlightened and recognize and turns from it. Then it loses power. False ideas only have power because people believe them. True ideas have power in and of themselves. And when a true idea is planted as a seed in the mind, it will grow of its own power, just as the egg. Mama doesn't give the nutrients to the egg. That egg grows and takes what it needs from mama, and mama better eat what she's told to eat, or life is going to be miserable, right? So such is the idea with true ideas. Yes, in the back. Oh, well, one thing that...
everything starts there, not in the middle.
This book in particular is a book of articles, a dozen or two articles on theosophical subjects, written in such a way so that's one can become so familiar with the philosophy, and the reason for that is because they're written in accordance with what we call the fundamental propositions of theosophy. And we probably already heard these propositions spoken in this class already. The first one has to do with what is God, deity. That deity is not a being, but that deity simply is a divine, ever-present principle in nature. It's a beautiful idea. You know, nobody can say what it looks like. Nobody can say that it likes me better than you. There are no attributes or qualifications about deity. It simply is and is forever. That's the first proposition in theosophy. Test it for yourself. The second proposition is that everything that occurs, occurs according to law, the law of cycles. Creation comes forth, emanates, manifests according to the law, not because there's a God in heaven who made the earth with Adam. That's a different way of thinking. If we view it as everything occurs under law, then there's no God deciding who he likes better than the other guy. It's a matter of how's my life going? It's probably related directly to how wise am I and how consistent am I living my life according to the universal law. So the second proposition is all about law, especially with regards to karma, for the human being, and with regards to how karma is carried out in the life and lives of a human being through reincarnation. So that's the second. There's deity, there's law, and the third simply is evolution. That has to do, Mr. Crosby in this article is saying that a person who lives according to the universal religion eventually finds himself knowing the very essence of everything in nature. And that's because we've come to know the very essence of ourselves. That's what the third fundamental proposition is, evolution. It states that we are, in essence, fundamentally identical with the oversoul of the universe. That's who we are. And we are a microcosm of it, and we are on a pilgrimage through this period of evolution to learn everything that can be learned so that come the end, with the purpose of all of evolution, simply to consciously know that we are one with everything, and along the path of that pilgrimage to assist in the raising up of all of the kingdoms of nature and contributing in every way that we can to humanity. There's a question?
Yeah, to the point about the sun worship and
sure.
The idea that we are light, I think it's more something like we are, because light in and of itself is like a pure, it's one thing. I think that we are illuminated, but there does have to be like a form that's illuminated. I think that form is like the yin or female half of the universe. And even how like all these creation stories have like the sort of light or the mind, but then also the body. And I think that those three things you were talking about, like the deity and the law and the evolution, is like the deity is sort of that genderless like initial principle that contains both the law and the evolution, and then there's like the, to me the law would be the like Ananka, the necessity for something to happen when it proceeds, and then the actual motion in itself, the evolution, that's the chronos, that's the light that shines and shows the procession of things. But I definitely think that there's, it's sort of like saying like an idea as we know it is not pure, it has to be written down or expressed in a form, in like a body, in words. And so that's, I think, the other half of those ideas is that maybe, you know, there is some pure ultimate idea that exists as one thing, but the way that we encounter ideas are in forms.
Sure. Well, the philosophy would say that one pure ultimate idea that exists without form is universal brotherhood. And universal brotherhood, regardless of the form or whether there's no form, is the fact from nature. So when we find ourselves in these forms, if we think and live and operate from that basis, then we're thinking and living and operating from the one fundamental universal law. Now the idea here was bringing, there was an analogy that was a useful analogy that was made in terms of, you know, we're light and light is one, but we do need these physical, you know, we need a form in through which to express. Let's remember that light, if we look at soul, the highest essence of soul that we can think of, we'll call it the oversoul, and light, there's a helpful analogy here, what we were talking about, with regard to evolution, because each one of us is a microcosm or an individualized ray of that light. Similarly, in science, we know, yes, light is one, light is a wave, and in science, we also know that light is a proton or a photon. So light as particles acts as a wave, and light as a wave can act like particles, and neither cancel each other out, so it's kind of both. We can also say that soul is one and it acts as one, and soul as one can be individualized. When we find ourselves in a place of individualization, it's incumbent upon ourselves. That's the goal. That's the whole process of evolution, to remember, really, we're the one. And if we remember that we're the one, and unlearn all the stuff that distracts us from that knowledge, then as we operate among the many, we're really operating among the one, and we're contributing to the purpose of what? Of the whole, to lift the whole. Yes, there's a question in the back.
Well, we would like to make a loaf of bread.
We can't hear you.
We would like to make a loaf of bread.
A loaf, okay.
Bread. Where do we begin? Not with the baking. We have to have something. What is bread made of? We all know. We have to prepare the soil.
Sure.
We have to plant the seeds. We have to fertilize. We have to harvest the wheat.
Got it. Got it. So where do we begin with all this? You know, folks walk in to this lodge. It's just so interesting. Inquirers, students, some people have been, as you come into a life knowing that you like just brilliant and wise, and others really, probably most of us seekers, I've been here, I've looked at this, I've read these books, what else is there? And maybe we find, there's something going on here. But it's deep and it's broad, you know, it's as deep as you want it to get. Well, the teachings simply are that we start with living a life of virtue. Just be who you are, live for the right reasons, act as you see fit unto you. And if our interest is to grow in wisdom, and we follow this philosophy, now if we follow this philosophy with the interest of I want to get wiser and use it for me so I can prove how to, you're going to get really bored around here because it just doesn't work that way. But if we're really interested in learning and growing as a result of the efforts, just think, you know, doing it oneself or being in concert with a group of like-minded thinkers, we get a lot further, a lot faster, don't we? But it starts with virtue. Why? Because virtue, say the founders, is what? Moral courage. It's the inner conviction just to do the right thing because it has nothing to do with what I'm going to get, but I'm going to do the right thing because of the right thing in whatever area of our lives that we live. So is anybody watching us doing this and deciding, okay, that person's good enough? No. By living that way, we're actually setting up within our own nature certain causes and effects which create like a magnetism toward, you know, nature recognizes one who works with her. And so just by living the life, we come to learn and grow more. And so Mr. Judge says that's the first step is to live a life of virtue. Yes, in the red?
But this is a very hard civilization in which to do that. I mean, we're surrounded by, you have to be competitive. You have to be selfish. You have to look out for yourself. And what you should be wanting is more of this and more of that. So we think Theosophy's very practical method for starting is to become a scientist first. Look at your own behavior and see, why do I do that? What am I after? Because until we understand what we want, the virtue just becomes a nice facade and we're going to trip sooner or later. So you might as well start out on the right basis. Figure out why you aren't virtuous. You have a reason.
So step one is find out any lack of virtue within us and see what we need to do about that. But the point is, you're the scientist, the world is your laboratory. That requires effort. It doesn't require TV. So we got to turn a couple of knobs. We got to turn the TV knob off. We got to open the doorknob and get out there and experiment. And when the more we learn about ourselves, the more we will learn about ourselves. And it's an ever-evolving process if we have the right motives. So the contribution had a lot to do with, if I'm not as virtuous as I know I could be, what is it? It has to do with our desires or motives. We could check that out. Yes?
The ocean of theosophy, or even the secret doctrine of the literature. And I think my thoughts just ran away. talks about gods, which they don't use that word, they say perfected beings,
right.
and they draw parallels to like Jesus and Buddha, Zoroaster, Confucius, and they hold it in of beings. And why? Why do they talk about adepts and perfected beings? You're just going to confuse everyone. You think that there's gods, hanging out around us. Why this idea of perfected beings?
So we all heard the question, why this idea of perfected beings? But we're also probably keenly aware that across civilizations and throughout time, all nations, in one way or another, had their highest spiritual teacher or their highest savior or their philosopher. So theosophy teaches that when we see certain consistent universal patterns or facts, that there's probably a truth going on there. And we would say that the source of pure wisdom, the expression of which today is in the theosophical literature, test that for yourself, there's no dogma here, you don't have to believe it, but the source of it is these advanced, evolved human beings, Mahatmas, Christs, Buddhas. And the teaching simply is that there are many. You know, some we know of religions that have been started in the name of, but there are more than just that. They're probably walking around us somewhere, somehow. We don't know. But the point is, they're a fact. They have to be a fact. If evolution is true, then there are some folks who are further along the lines than we are, and maybe we're further along the lines in some ways than other people are, but the teaching is there are those who have perfected themselves, who have learned and developed to the maximum possibility that a human being can in this period of evolution. So we're not talking about an absolutely perfect being, we're talking about a being who has perfected himself in this period as much as possible. And the last thing we would say is that in theosophy, we don't play who's who in the zoo and what's his name and where does he go and all this kind of stuff. The issue here is test it for yourself. See if that idea is probably true. And the student of theosophy will find that all that really matters in terms of what do I need to do in life is to live a life along the lines of those teachings, because there's no savior that's going to do it for you. But they can point out the way. They can give the teachings. They can be an example if you study the lives of great teachers or masters. But what matters is not who they are, but that they are. Now, there was a hand in the back here. Yes.
Yes, it's interesting how a great spiritual teacher will come from time to time, periodically. Have any of these great spiritual teachers actually founded a religion? And if so, how come not?
When
we end up with all these religions, we've had several spiritual teachers, aren't they mostly all saying exactly the same thing?
You know, we've heard that the only thing that Jesus actually wrote was in the sand when he was saying, let he without sin throw the first stone. And we wonder if that word in the sand is not just a metaphor, you know? So we understand that, you know, we hear that, you know, Buddha said this, Buddha said that. There's a lot of teachings from the Buddha, from those who came after him, who by word of mouth, but we can't know that Buddha actually sat down and wrote it. Our understanding is that definitely he did not write anything down. So there's something about this pattern of true spiritual masters have not started their own religion. Their purpose is not to arrive on the scene and build a church. And, careful, yet, those spiritual masters are all members of the fraternity of adepts. There's no one who's more powerful than the other. The issue is the teaching. And they have brought at different times to different groups in different periods of civilizations those teachings necessary to those civilizations. Now, the point here being, if this religion is bigger and that religion is smaller, that doesn't really mean anything. What matters is when they arrive on the scene, are they recognized for who they are? And what do the people in that time and place do with what they've been taught? How much of the teachings have come and gone, and civilizations are come and gone, when it was right there waiting for them? And other times it would seem that in the course of civilization, there was real impact made by the teacher, when actually no, the work was done by the students of that teacher and the people who were willing to make the changes in their own minds and hearts. So the teaching is one, the source of the teaching is all one, yes?
We think in answer to the question, why are they brought up?
Yes.
It is that they are the ones who gave us what we now know as theosophy.
Mm-hmm.
In other days, it's been called other things, but it's ancient wisdom, and it's part of a religion that in past lives we knew as the ancient wisdom religion. So they came to correct the ideas,
right,
to point again towards truth, because we drift away from it so easily.
Thank you for this contribution. Yes, so the source of theosophy very definitely is the adepts. It is the ancient wisdom tradition restated in the 1800s in ways that today we can still understand. Yes.
You think the analogy is used that this is a path, this is a journey, and thankfully each summer we study the Bhagavad Gita, which points out the path and how to live the life and how to be in harmony with nature, because we read it and next week, oh, what did I read? We have to read it again. But it seems to be our nature that we have to imbue ourselves with these ideas and keep them alive in us throughout the week, because we forget them, because we live in a world that is the complete opposite. So we're thankful for the Gita.
Yes, so we're thankful for the Gita, and it takes repetition to keep this in our mind. Some folks, you know, we all know, some people go to church on Sundays and they get back there again on Sundays, and the other 6 days of the week, who knows? But guess what? McDonald's knows how important it is to keep on telling us how important their French fries are. We see, how many commercials do we see, you know? So if we just take some advice and review that in our, perhaps our daily meditation, to review these ideas and make ourselves a part of a group, whether here or elsewhere, that recognizes the value of these ideas. And one thing we'll mention, as we said, we're starting the Bhagavad Gita on Wednesday evenings, and we've learned that, you know, the Bhagavad Gita is one small part of a greater work called the Mahabharata, and we've heard the Mahabharata, this huge work, is a metaphor or even the story or the allegory of the evolution of the human race. It can take lifetimes to read, but that tiny little part in the Bhagavad Gita is the period in this story of human development that teaches men, women, mankind, humanity, to control their mind and to learn the value of what it is to be a true self, capital S-E-L-F, rather than the small S-E-L-F. So you're certainly all invited to the Wednesday night classes, which begin this Wednesday and will go on through the summer. With that, our Sunday morning meeting is adjourned.